Hello and welcome to the IMD Podcast Network. Today we're bringing you another episode of Inside the Transition, IMD's sustainability podcast, hosted by Professors Julia Binder and Knut Harnes. They'll be in discussion with Marie-Laurée Schaufelberger, PicTech Group's Chief Sustainability Officer. They'll be talking about how investors assess transition opportunities and how sustainable finance is changing.
Hello, I'm Julia Binder.
And I'm Knut Harnes.
And this is Inside the Transition, the IMD podcast that gives you a behind-the-scenes look at the energy transition and what it means for executives and their businesses.
So in this episode, we're looking at the role of finance in the transition and how the flows of capital are shaping what actually gets built. The need for investment is skyrocketing across the clean energy, industry, mobility, cities, and nature. But capital doesn't move automatically. Investors must evaluate risks, policy, corporate strategy, and of course also the long-term value, and often in entirely new ways.
Few people have a broader view of sustainable finance than our guest today. Marie-Laurée Schaufelberger is PicTech Group's Chief Sustainability Officer in charge of the group's responsible investment vision, ESG governance, and stewardship across both client portfolios and the firm's own assets. She sits at the intersection of sustainability, capital markets, and real economy transformation. Marie-Laurée is also the president of Sustainable Finance Geneva and the vice chair of the Building Bridges Foundation, a major Swiss platform convening finance, policy, and civil society.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I'm very happy to be with you and Knut today.
So today we're going to talk about how investors assess transition opportunities, how engagement and stewardship are evolving, where capital is flowing, and of course, where it isn't, and what business leaders should expect as sustainability finance enters its next chapter.
Sustainable finance is changing quickly, shaped by regulation, market pressure, geopolitics, and new technologies. But is it delivering at the scale the transition demands? What are investors looking for? And how can companies position themselves to attract the capital they need? Marie-Laurée, it's such a pleasure to have you here. And you've had such a distinctive journey into sustainable finance, from international relations to thematic equities, environmental strategies. And now you are the one shaping PicTech's whole approach to responsible investment. When you look back, what actually pulled you into this space? Was there a moment when you thought, okay, this is where I can really have an impact?
It's a good question because it's been almost 2 decades now. Time really does fly. And I was never destined to being in finance in the first place. I have a background in international relations. Thought I would end up working for an NGO or for an international organization, especially being here in Geneva. But was lucky enough to kind of by accident fall into PicTech more than 18 years ago. And just realize the sheer scale of financial markets and the impact that investment decisions have every day on driving real world outcomes. And that made me go down the rabbit hole that is sustainable finance. And I think was something that was always a very intellectually stimulating place to be, but with time became an increasingly impactful place to be. And I think that's why I ended up in this space. And what's very interesting is at the beginning, it was very much a finance only game, and we'll talk about it. So really understanding how to integrate environmental, social, governance factors into our investment decision making, into how we run our operations. And increasingly now is something that needs to be done in partnership with others, because as we'll talk about extensively, this is not a one sector game. Right? This is going to be fundamental industry transformations across our economy and our societies. And that's also why it's really exciting to be involved in things like building bridges that helps to kind of bring all these different stakeholders around the table.
You know, when our MBA students ask me, or maybe Julia as well, where in sustainability should we be focusing to find a job kind of for our career? And at least I always say, look at where there are investments. Because where you find investments, you find the dynamism, you find new opportunities, etc. And in a way, you sit right in the center of that. You sit across governance, investment teams, clients, of course, stewardship as well. So you kind of have the privilege of a, let's call it the wide angle view. So how does this combination shape the way you see what's going on now? What's happening right now?
What's happening right now is that the rubber is hitting the road. I think for many, many years, there were discussions around setting targets, around kind of how each player could contribute to their own sustainability transition or the transformation. And I think what we're seeing right now is the very real trade-offs that are going to be required in our economies and societies from the forthcoming transition, where there will be winners and losers. And I find that really interesting because we've gone over the last kind of 5 to 10 years from lofty goals and target setting, and which was important, right, to set that kind of, say, there's a North Star, the policy with the Paris Agreement gave us that North Star. What does it mean for business? What does it mean for own target setting? To a pushback, which I think you've also addressed in a previous podcast, from the people, the real people, their everyday lives that are being impacted by the transition that's ongoing right now. And unless we can reconnect or connect what's happening within economies, within organizations to people's everyday lives, we're going to get pushback because there are trade-offs, because there are everyday people that are set to win and lose. And I think that's been, for me, the major transformation over the last kind of year or two in the sustainability landscape has been this understanding that unless we can connect to people's real issues, we're going to lose out. We're going to lose momentum. We're going to lose policy direction because, especially in democratic countries, we're not going to have people on board and willing to go ahead because they can't see what's in it for them. And I think that also means we're at a time that's very exciting because we're going to have real talk, right? And if you look at the space of sustainable finance or finance generally, you had a lot of lofty discussions around, you know, finance will save the world, or if we can just drive enough capital, we're going to be able to solve all these problems. But actually, it's not just about driving that capital, right? It's actually about being able to explain within in different industry and societal segments what the transition is going to mean and what it's going to mean for people. And unless we can do that, we won't have the policy certainty that will also drive more capital. But the capital is flowing where the economics are. And we're seeing that very, very clearly with, for example, renewable energy, which despite the short term kind of last 3 years where the stocks have kind of fallen in renewable energy by about 30% and rebounded this year by about 20%, we've also seen really interesting investments and opportunities in areas like waste management and improving recycling, which actually has risen 60% over the past 3 years and had potentially more muted performance in 25. So I would say the short-term picture is always a little bit volatile. But if we look over the past decade, right, where the MSCI world has delivered about 240%, environmental consulting companies, waste management companies have increased value by 400%. Energy efficiency solutions, they've seen an average share increase of 600%. Compare that to leading fossil fuel sector indices and ETFs. If you look over the last kind of decade, it's been 117%. So that's under the global market. And that is vastly under the environmental consultants, waste managers, the efficiency solutions. So to your point, Knut, you know, follow a little bit where that, you know, where the money is, you can see that the long-term trend is very different from the headlines you're seeing. I think there's another really important piece to all of this. We tend to talk about the energy transition. Yes, that's massive. But for investors to fully capture this opportunity, we need to look at the planetary boundary transition, right? This is what's happening right now. We're moving from being an economy that works outside of the planetary boundaries to an economy that's going to transition towards inside the safe operating space, right? And that's why it's not just an energy play. It's an agriculture play. It's a green chemistry play. It's a future of our food systems, our industries play. And that's really, really exciting because when you start to look at that, the performance is compelling for private investors.
Marie-Laure, this was extremely rich. Let me just capture a couple of these. So you're basically advocating, and I think that's super important to say, let's not just focus about the environment or energy, but actually broaden our perspective. A, we need to understand who are the people behind the transition. B, we need to broaden the topic from energy to actually look at the planetary boundaries. And then you're basically saying, actually, we already see that it does make business sense for a couple of industries. And let me maybe just double down on this a little bit and ask you, you mentioned energy, you mentioned waste management as really seeing some significant capital flows. What about heavy industry, mobility, cities, other nature topics that we're talking about? Do you see anywhere you really say there is really momentum right now? Where is it that investors really lean in and not just talk about, as you mentioned before, right? The first wave of investing was a lot of talking. And then maybe vice versa, where do you feel we're stuck? Where do you feel there are super important areas, but actually we're not really getting this right at the moment?
It's a really good question. There's a lot to unpack. So I think this focus on planetary boundaries versus only looking at like the energy piece or one, a single sector play, right? Just like the finance industry is not going to solve all of this by directing more capital, you're not going actually to have a silver bullet through one single sector. But that's actually really exciting for investors because that means that you can actually have an opportunity set that swaths the whole economy and not just one part of it. So I think what's working, as we mentioned, is taking this overarching view and looking at things beyond just the renewable energy play. That's so important. And people tend to think, and you know, transition, energy transition, renewable energy, that has underperformed, you know, in the last, you know, 3 years, but they're forgetting to zoom out and get that bigger picture that actually the efficiency and solutions piece are increasing in value. And I'm going to tell you, this is going to increase also over time because we know that we are already at one, you know, close to 1.5 degree threshold. And we're already needing to adapt even within this context where we're getting close to 1.5 degrees, right? Our economies, our real estate, our infrastructure, all of these things will need to adapt. That's also an enormous investment opportunity. So you asked me about what's coming down the line. This is a very, very big part of all of it. We've talked a lot about mitigation. We've talked a lot about the transition of our energy systems. That's great. That's where the economics are working. The vast amount of the economics work there. It's not just the economics that work with renewable energy, which is cheaper very often, actually all the time, when you look at wind and solar relative to deploying fossil energy. But it's also a time perspective, right? As we deploy more AI, as we need to reindustrialize swaths of Europe to face that energy demand, the fastest and cheapest way to face that is deploying renewables. Deploying a gas pipeline takes 5 years to get a turbine, right? Nuclear, let's not even talk about how much time it takes to actually get that deployed. So there's a time and a cost perspective. But looking further down the line, this adaptation opportunity, and we will get to the physical risks, right, which are going up because there's some compelling data there. But there's not just the risk side. There's the fact that we are going to need to deploy massive amounts of investments in the space of adaptation. And here, just to give you again a couple of numbers, right? The World Resource Institute says that for every $1 invested in adaptation, you're actually generating more than $10 in benefits over the next decade, right? There's some really, really interesting numbers also and research by Swiss Re that suggests that the cost-benefit ratio of adaptation investments in infrastructure, in real estate, in agriculture, vary between 2-to-1 or 10-to-1. So you're getting like that 2-to-1 benefit or 10-to-1 for every dollar or Swiss franc invested, typically with higher ratios in lower income countries. So the lower the income country, the higher your benefit is for that dollar invested. We're going to get to that need to invest more in emerging markets and the opportunity that also represents for investors. And so, you know, even just in the OECD, $600 billion needed to invest to climate-proof infrastructure by 2030. And we're not even talking about moving to a 2-degree scenario, which will actually increase those needs. So maybe to answer that question, right, let's think beyond just renewables. Let's think beyond mitigation. Let's start to look at those very real needs in adaptation and resilience, which in and of themselves are actually less exposed to the volatility of climate policy developments because they are things that you need to deploy on the ground. You need them. They will happen.
You opened the door a little bit to this, the bigger global picture. You talked about the emerging markets and the investment opportunities. So if we take a big view here on the globe, different regions, of course, Europe, we focus on Europe, US, Asia, with, of course, China, the whole renewables, but also emerging markets. What kind of, if you compare them, what do you see? And not least, where do you see that we're bald Where do you see bold action?
Maybe taking a step back, that's such a good question. And there's so much to unpack. I think it's a big one. But you know what? We're in a time that's so exciting, interesting, volatile. Also, let's face it, scary for a lot of people. And we need to recognize that. But from a financial market perspective, we are coming out of the paradigm of the post-war order, where a lot of the investments were actually just de facto driven to the US, right? There's a 26 trillion difference between what the world invests in the US and how much the US invests in the world. So there's a net investment position of the US that represents about 90% of their GDP, right? The world invests massively. US debt, US equities. Right. It's 70% of capital markets are US. This was something that was accepted and worked when it was perceived to be a risk-free asset, right? And where you were getting superior equity returns that were driven by superior technological capability emanating from the US market. We think, you know, this is something, or you can see, right, that this is something that's being challenged now. The technological dominance of the United States relative to a player like China and some of the other BRICS economies that are rising, and even Europe in some areas, is being challenged, which means that what used to be invested just de facto in the US, because it was risk, it made more sense from a risk perspective, risk return perspective, is now being changed. And that is opening up an enormous opportunity to think about how that capital from large institutional investors is going to be redeployed, is being redeployed as we speak, probably towards transition plans and the needs, the security needs, the technological needs, the adaptation and resilience needs of their own economies or of other markets, where it's going to start to look very interesting to diversify your exposure away from a market that benefited from probably a lot more capital over the last couple of years. So that's, I think that's a really important picture to keep in mind. So now let's talk also about China, right? China refines 90% of the minerals that are needed, not just for the clean energy transition we were talking about before, that goes into our technology, into security and defense, 90% of the refining of those minerals. The US refines oil and gas, 20% of the market. And so what's very interesting is you're starting to see the policy certainty also emerging from China, which, you know, despite the fact they represent 30% of global emissions, those emissions are in part being generated to pivot not just their economy, but large parts of the world towards electrification and green energy. They deployed over the last decade, over $1.5 trillion in renewable energy. That's three times the US. That's twice as much as Europe. You know, Chinese manufacturers, 65% of global demand for renewables-related equipment. So I think that's a really important picture to keep in mind when we think, as investors, where capital is going to be deployed. And if you look at emerging markets, right, to look at then how this is impacting the world, this dominance and this capacity to create also products and solutions that can help green other economies at a price point that makes sense for them is allowing also now a lot of emerging markets to potentially leapfrog, right, and to start to deploy some of these solutions a lot faster than we would have imagined before. Look at the case of Pakistan. You can look at the case of Vietnam that went from like 160th in solar capacity to one of the top 10 markets over the course of a couple of years. And that's linked to policy incentives in those countries, but also to the availability of technology that is at a price point that can be deployed. And if I'm placing myself now as an investor in terms of where I want to be deploying capital and how I want to be diversifying the capital that I manage on behalf of clients, on behalf of beneficiaries, pension beneficiaries, it starts to look really interesting to potentially start to increase your exposure to some of these emerging markets that offer diversification benefits, but also are benefiting from these long-term trends.
Marie-Laure, I have a question with that respect, because I think it's interesting. We talk a lot about the US, we talk a lot about China, and then we also talked about emerging economies. What's your vision for Europe? Where does Europe, does it still play a role in the transition? And if so, from your investor lens, where is it that you would put real money into the European markets?
Europe is obviously a very important player, and not least also because for many, many years they continue, I think, despite some struggles now, to have a vision for the transition of their energy systems, of food systems, probably had a huge emphasis on the regulatory piece. I think now we're seeing the pendulum swing a little bit. But the economic case, this geostrategic case, the industrial case for the transition is still very, very much, if not even more important today in Europe than it was before. Right, because I always smile, we talk a lot about defense and security and the need to redeploy capital and deploy capital into defense. And that's important, right? You have to be able to defend yourself. That's also the basis. But defense, security, is not just about having weapons systems, right? And armament. It's about resilience. It's about adaptation. It's about securing your energy systems. It's about having, you know, great grids. It's about using, and this is where I get really excited about Europe, the brains that you have. If you start to think like not individual countries, but like 500 million Europeans. And I think that's the big challenge for Europe. And also the fact that they can't actually, because there's no capital markets union, because they can't actually go out and raise capital for common resilience adaptation goals, mitigation goals. That's probably going to be a challenge that needs to be addressed in the next couple of years. But if that could be addressed, if we could kind of move from this mindset of individual countries to this is a bioregion, right? We were talking also about nature at one point. This is a bioregion where we have a dependence and an interest in working together. And you know, I'm reminded of this quote. I think it was President Tusk in Poland when there were all these issues with Russia and Ukraine and everything. And he was saying, you know, this is kind of absurd. We have a situation where kind of 500 million Europeans are asking 300 million Americans to help protect them from 140 million Russians. And of course, this is very specific and it's linked to a very stressful situation with open conflict in Europe, and we have to recognize that. But the fundamental point he's making there is stronger together, right? And and that maybe we have an interest in seeing it that way. And there, given the amount of intellectual capacity and the fact that rules and regulations do matter, I think the pendulum needs to be balanced, but that policy level, regulatory level also gives you some certainty. If that and the brains and the coming together can be kind of clarified over the coming years, that will be a very interesting place to be, this whole European revival question.
Super, thank you. Wow, that's a big picture. And you might be aware that one of our colleagues, Arturo Brees, he just came out with a book called Super Europe, and it does exactly this. It talks about the it's not a given, but there's an opportunity there, right? There's the Europe opportunity. It has a lot to do with confidence. It has a lot to do with investing. And part of the opportunity is what we're talking about, creating the more, let's say, sustainable society, which is competitive. So I think that's super relevant.
And I think there's a really important point on one, there's a believing in ourselves and believing in the future and being, you know, positive. I grew up in Southeast Asia. I was in markets that were growing as I was growing as a human, and saw the amounts of positivity and optimism that comes from this mindset that the future will be better than the past, because the path of human progress is that the future is better than the past. As a woman, there is no time in history where I would rather be on this planet. And I hope that for my two daughters, and I think so, because that's what human progress shows, their life will be better when they are my age than mine, right? And so I think we need that renewed sense of optimism and probably leadership that infuses that. And there's a second piece which is linked to this, which is also risk-taking. You don't get anything in life, and you don't get anything in investing if you do not take a certain amount of risk. And I think for many years, we've gone towards this kind of zero-risk society. We've outsourced a number of things, you know, to others that then they take the risk. And we I think, in Europe also need to start to lean in a little bit, to taking a little bit more risk, to creating new partnerships, to sometimes it's not going to be perfectly aligned with what we had in mind. But, you know, there's trade-offs and pragmatism involved. So that optimism coupled with the risk-taking, I think, is so important. Something Americans you know, in the risk-taking space, you know, we can learn some things from, and actually from the Chinese and many emerging economies as well.
Super, thank you. I think that's so relevant right now. And if I just step a little bit back and reflect on what you're saying and link it to not only energy transition, but sustainability as well, I think you could make the argument that at least in Europe, if you looked at the last 10 years, it was a lot about playing not to lose. Regulations, it was disclosure, reporting, etc. Now we're in a new era, and that's the whole discussion, right? And I think for those who are playing this new era to win, there's lots of opportunity, but it doesn't come by itself. It requires, as you say, investing. It actually requires believing in it as well. So I really like that point, Marie-Laure. And now I want to take us from the very big picture, the global picture, you know, the investment flows, all the way down to the companies. And just ask you to share with us a little bit. If you look at companies that are now coming into this space, making investments, etc., and looking at it from the bank perspective, what matters most when you look at the different companies wanting to make investments about the future? What is it really that makes some stand out, and what you're really looking for when they make these kind of, yeah, not only you call them planetary boundary type investments, let's say energy transition and beyond type investments?
Yeah, so there's broad-based, if you look at it from an investment perspective, you have what we would call the kind of solutions providers, right? You could almost call those the disruptors. Those are the companies that are going to come in, and they're going to change the way the economy is operating by offering a new technology, a new solution. Here, this is the textbook case, is the renewables versus the fossil fuel, right? We have new solutions that are actually displacing the old way of doing things. But that's not the vast majority from an investment perspective. That's a really interesting opportunity set, but it's not the vast majority of the opportunity. The vast majority of the opportunity is what we would call kind of the transition, which is very linked to this podcast block, right? Which was the companies that are moving from brown to green, that are moving from degenerative to regenerative, from, you know, these linear to circular, right? To use some of the terms that are used out there. And those companies are going to need to deploy the solutions coming from the solutions providers, but also some rather boring stuff, but that is available, right? The efficiency plays, the water system, you know, upgrades, the, you know, all of these things are actually technologies and solutions that exist. We're always thinking at the leading edge, right? Which is good. You need that technology piece. The disruptors will help you shift to a new place, a new system, but actually a lot of the tech or the needs in the transition, it's really about getting the 90% of the companies across sectors, across geographies to implement that within their own business and operations. And you asked me what the most important part is. The most important is governance. We underestimate the importance of governance. And you have some people doing great work on governance at IMD. So, you know, and I see you smiling. This is key because in the absence of strong governance, things don't get done. And what I mean governance is, what is that board level, not just commitment, but competence on the issues that are truly material to the company in question? Because what is material to a pharma company in terms of transition is not going to be the same as a power company, a real estate firm, or a food and beverage company. But at that board level, do you have the competence on the critical planetary boundary linked themes or technological linked disruptions that mean that that board is able to set the strategy and hold management to account on that? And I think as investors for many, many years, notably on the topic of like stewardship and responsible investing, there's been some really great work around engagement and stewardship and voting. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But I think the next 5 years will be a lot more focused on the governance piece. And I think that's a good thing because that's where we ultimately have the most power. We elect the board, we vote out board members. Investors don't tend to vote out board members very much. I think it's like 2 or 3%. Tend to vote against members of the board. And yet we know that that vote makes a difference because board members, even when they lose like 1 or 2% of a vote, they will actually try and understand why. They will reach out. That actually has quite a material impact. Instead of investors being overly focused on trying to push firms in one direction or another from a, you know, technology deployment perspective. That's not our role, right? Our role is to make sure that board, you know, that the company has good oversight, good governance, management is being held accountable, you know, that there's transparency, good shareholder right protections. So let's go back to where our core strength is and our core focus and our core added value to the system. So I think that's going to be a very, very big one, because in the absence of good governance, very little gets achieved.
That's great. Thank you. Can I jump one quick follow-up to this, Marie-Laure? Governance is the foundation, right? But maybe all companies don't think about that when they approach whatever, funders, consortia, etc. What is it that companies get wrong in this space?
Let me give you an example of a very concrete example that's also linked to regulation over the past couple of years. So you know that in Europe, we had this like wave, like SFDR, CSRD, like actually a wave of acronyms, which, you know, hasn't helped the sustainability community. But fundamentally, if you take the example of the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, CSRD, which mandates kind of much better disclosures around the material, environmental, social, and governance topics for firms, and which mandates not just a view of the risks to the business of these environmental, social, you know, factors, but also a view of the impacts of the business on various environmental and social issues. Very often within firms, this was taken as a tick the box approach. And so board level meetings were squandered. And I say squandered because you would go into a meeting with these very critical parts of your stakeholders, right, that you don't get a lot of access to. And so people were going into these meetings to get these reports approved, right? And it was being run very much in a box ticky approach, right? Is it in line with the legal expectation? You know, is the board comfortable with what's being published outside? You know, how little can we say to still be in line with regulatory expectation? Oh God, and all these fear mongers around as well, like the consultants that were telling you had to report on 1,500 different data points, and everyone kind of scared about that. And in all of that, what was lost is, what are we trying to achieve? And what is strategically important for the board to know about the material, environmental, social, and governance factors that are going to have an impact on how we run our business and on how profitable we are or not over the long term. And so instead of focusing on, wow, this double materiality analysis, which for the time being is not perfect, but has flagged that climate change is actually really important in this part of our business because we're heavily exposed, for example, as a financial institution, to the utilities sector, and we're mitigating that through stewardship efforts, through XYZ. Instead of having these really important conversations on product evolution, on consumer changes, on policy, et cetera, it's this box ticking. Are we in line? How little can we publish outside, you know, to still be in line with regulatory expectation? I think that is so important. And those that are getting it right, they're on that strategic opportunity spectrum. They're not in the compliance tick the box approach.
That was super insightful. You took us really on a journey to say it's not just technology, it's also governance. It's not just compliance, it's also opportunity, right? And I think I will now take us one level up again. And you also mentioned that a lot of the changes we need to see are more on a systems level, right? So when we talk about agriculture or energy or mobility, this is not like a single company game anymore. You also mentioned it's not finance that is a silver bullet. And I think I've often said technology is not a silver bullet. It's an important puzzle piece. Finance is not a silver bullet. It's an important puzzle piece, right? So we're in this puzzle game. And here I want to actually tap into your experience and your exposure to building bridges, because your role within building bridges gives you this unique panoramic view of the system where you bring together investors and regulators, civil society, corporates, startups, and so on. When you see all these actors together, what becomes clear for you about the transition and what needs to happen that you won't see when you're just inside a single either financial institution or corporate institution?
This is such a good question. And I think the big challenge going forward is going to be that we know we need to have a broad set of stakeholders around the table in order to advance on some of this systems level change. Without the systems level change, we won't be able to make meaningful change within individual industries. Very good example is if you take a portfolio, financial portfolio today, and you want to make it kind of net zero, the only way to do that is to exclude, right? So you exclude some of the high emitting sectors, and then yeah, your portfolio is net zero. But what does that even mean? Because the companies that you've sold the shares of are the shares are bought by someone else. And there has been zero real decarbonization in the economy from that decision of excluding, right? So then you logically get to this point where like, okay, actually, we're not going to exclude, we're going to engage to get that real economy decarbonization. And so you engage with individual actors, but those individual actors, when they can make the change, they will. Like, so you kind of, that's what we've had over the past couple of years is the incremental improvement where there were low-hanging fruits that were not dependent on the system level change, which is your point, Julia, right? And now we're realizing, and this is what I see in the conversations, and we saw it also at COP this year with the action agenda. You know, you get up and you're like, okay, to move into the system level change, the ultimate portfolio decarbonization from the real economy needs to be done at that system level. And that's where it gets challenging because for a couple of years we've been trying, and I think there's Building Bridges, but there's a lot of other organizations that try to do this as well. You bring a whole bunch of stakeholders around the table to kind of address this system change. And I think we're gaining maturity from the last couple of years where we realize that it's not about just having a lot of different stakeholders coming together, but actually it's about ensuring that the conversations of the stakeholders are curated in a focused, action-oriented way per challenge, industry, thematic, right? And unless you're having proper curated conversations, you're not going to, it's just going to be a lot of people talking. And that's the talk shop fatigue, I think, that people are coming out of now. And what's exciting about the next 5 years, I think, is that we're going to be structuring the conversations in a much more focused way. And this is true of Building Bridges, but I see this happening across the system, right? People are getting organized around communities of action. If you're in nature finance, what are you working on? Is it nature on the balance sheet for corporates? Okay, so let's get organized with the corporates, with the policymakers that are linked to that, with some of the prudential organizations potentially that could be thinking about this also in a regulatory context. Or is it nature finance linked to creating new and exciting opportunities to drive more capital for profit in the space of nature finance? And what I find really exciting now and what absolutely needs to happen is we need to start to organize and curate the communities of interest around much more specific action-oriented topics. Because otherwise, you get this kind of big soup of people talking at 30,000 view, which was necessary to get to where we are today. So that's important. But now we need to be a lot more intentional, which actually gets us to impact as well. And would love to say a couple words on that as well.
Super. Thank you. In a way, when I listen to you, my takeaway is a little bit that it's great to create systems, but it's not enough. The systems need leadership and they need a real agenda because otherwise they don't really move, they don't act, etc. And I want to take us a little bit into this, the leadership side of it. And we've indirectly talked about it, but, you know, what kind of maybe advice or what kind of things would you say to leaders of companies in different industries, given this, the energy transition, the needs for funding, partly funding what's new, but as you say, a lot of it is funding what's going on. What kind of advice do you have to leaders in this space?
I think the most important thing, and I've seen it within also the organization that I've you know, been lucky enough to be in for almost two decades now, is go to what is material to your business. So understand what the most material environmental and social and governance factors are to you and link that directly to your core business. Because that's what we've seen also with the financial industry over the last last year, right? With the change in administration in the US, you can see that a lot of players hadn't done that work. And so there was no actual conviction. And this can be true for technology as well, right? It's not just about the technology. It's how is the technological evolution in a particular area material to you as a firm? AI is going to be material to a financial institution in a very different way than it is material to a pharma company. yet it's important for both, but not in the same way. And it's the same with all of these factors. So get a really strong understanding about what is the most material piece for you as a firm in your industry, and then think about what this means for your products, your solutions, your advice to clients. And that's very much how we've gone about it at Picta as well, is really look at it in that way. And I have to admit that one of the reasons we've stuck to this agenda is because we have a material business in, you know, environmental themes. We're a market leader in that space. And we believe that that's something that will grow in the future. And therefore, we're leaning into it. And we're getting increasingly sophisticated about how we can deploy this. And that's because we see a business opportunity. I mean, you have players like CalPERS in the US that are, you know, these massive institutional investors, very sophisticated, you know, deploying $100 billion in climate solutions investing over the next until 2030, I think. They've deployed already around $60 billion of that. They're looking for another $40 billion in areas like adaptation. They're looking for solutions in public and private markets, in infrastructure, in local investing, in equities. This is a material business opportunity for those that are that have seen it and that are able to address it. But it's not a free lunch. The number one KPI for these big players, performance. These are not for benefit organizations, right? They're for profit. They have beneficiaries. They have a fiduciary to take these long-term trends into account and translate that into what they're delivering to their pensioners. I don't know if you saw GPIF, same direction, right? Writing is on the wall. GPIF, largest pension plan globally. It's in Japan, $1.8 trillion. They announced a couple months ago that they are really looking into how impact investing can be further deployed and have investment returns. Right? How does impact investing have a material performance edge? And they are going to deploy more in impact investing, starting with listed equities, which means we're moving from a world where impact investing was like kind of a really niche thing to a full portfolio approach across asset classes. Why is this happening? Because people understand that you have to reconnect financial flows and financial capital to real assets, to real resources. And in the case of GPIF, to government priorities around gender, around demographics with a fast aging population, redirecting that capital or directing that capital with an intention for a particular outcome, which is possible today because we have better data, better understanding, and we're starting to take a total portfolio approach on things and not just looking at a single asset class with a benchmarked view. And that will naturally lead us to a lot more impact investing.
I love that. And I think it's a very, very tangible advice also for business leaders to say, if you do your materiality assessment, don't just do it for a nice shiny report, but actually work with it strategically and really double click and understand what exactly now is material about that specific item for your company, which I think is a very actionable advice for our listeners. Marie-Laure, I think I could listen to you for another 2 hours, but we have to unfortunately also wrap up. And I would like to end on a, let's say, positive note. With everything going on in the world, not everything is positive at the moment. What gives you genuine optimism or hope that where you really think, actually, yeah, we can get this right, right? Despite all the setbacks, despite everything, some noise from some places in the world, we got this.
What always gives me hope is looking at the evidence of human evolution and this notion of progress, which I mentioned a little earlier, right? Like the human progress has always been kind of, you know, steps forward, then realizing that what we've done is probably not, it's not that simple, a better understanding, and then having to correct for what we've, you know, done. And at no time in history have we had more brains, more capacity, more information, more data, more technological evolution to tackle these challenges, and more intelligent people. This is why I also believe a lot in Europe, to tackle the problems that are inherent to human progress and have always been inherent. So that's kind of the mega picture of why I believe that the future will ultimately be better than the past. Now, is this a linear progression? Probably not, right? We know that in history you have swings and you have moments of regression. And when you're in the generation with the moment of regression, it's tough, right? And we have to recognize that. And it can also be a very divided picture across regions. But I heard something the other day that gave me so much hope, and I had never thought about it this way. I was at the JESDA conference here in Geneva, which is this accelerator for science and diplomacy, to really anticipate and ensure that science is informing policy and not the other way around. And someone on stage said something very true, and they said, you know, if you had asked people in 1939, 1940, 45, and you had told them in 1944 that the UN would be created in 45, and that we would have this incredible movement to kind of bring people together and start to create a global architecture, if you had told people that in 1939, they would not have believed you. That's like a 5-year, you know, even 3 years before. Because there's the headlines, and then there's the work happening underground that is preparing us for the next shift. And that's what all of us are trying to do, right? And that gives me so much hope. It's the same. You see the headlines of all the banks leaving the net zero alliances, you know, all of that. And you are like, okay, yeah, it's horrible. We're going back. What you're not seeing is the doubling down in a lot of financial institutions, including in the United States, on nature solutions, investments in climate, investments in adaptation, and the real solutions-oriented mindset going into that. How are we going to do? How are we going to deploy? How are we going to have intention? That's the signal. I focus on the signal, not the noise. That's how I keep hope.
Whoever you are listening to this, business leader, investor from different types of organizations, I hope the conversation today gave you some practical guidance, insights, and the context for what's going on. I personally really appreciated it. If you enjoyed the episode, please follow or subscribe and share it with your colleagues. We are all actually navigating these changes.
Marie-Laure, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing such an optimistic view of how sustainable finance and also the world is evolving.
Thank you, Knut. Thank you, Julia. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
That's all for this week. This podcast was proudly brought to you by the International Institute for Management Development in Lausanne. You can find out more at imd.org.